When did you start working with NHF? What year?
Well, I became a member in 1986, but in June 1989, I became its attorney, and I became its I became a member of the board.
Okay, and then.
And I've been on the board with one brief interruption in the early 90s when I voluntarily resigned because I was doing too much legal work for them and I thought it was too much of a conflict. So I resigned my position for a year or two, like in 91, 92.
Okay.
And then I got back on the board after that. And I've been on the board ever since. And I've been the president of the organization since the Maureen Solomon, the former president, who had been president for 20 years. She died in August 2006, and the vice president became acting president until we had an election for the board officer positions in January 2007, and I became the president then, and I've been the president ever since. So that's more than 15 years.
Wow. That is dedication. Now, how I actually have several questions, probably ones that you're not used to being asked because I'm going down a slightly different tunnel.
Yeah.
How often do you attend meetings?
Codex meetings?
Yeah.
It's pre-COVID and post-COVID. It's a little differently because they hold them electronically now by Zoom meetings.
Okay.
But in the past, you'd have to actually travel to the place. So, you know, there's the Codex Alimentarius Commission. It's the parent body within Codex.
Right.
And then they have all these little offspring, which are committees. They have, for example, Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses, abbreviated as CCNFSDU. And that's the first one that NHF started attending in 1997, I think, by paying for a reporter to go and listen in on the meeting. And then I went as an actual delegate in the year 2000. So that was the committee that we were mainly interested in and we were attending. But the other committees kind of fell quickly in place. And that's like, oh, and the CCNFSDU is hosted by the German government. So they provide the chairman or the chairwoman. They select the location, almost always in Germany, but sometimes they go elsewhere, like Cape Town, South Africa, or Santiago, Chile.
Does that ever change as far as the country who's heading a committee, or has it always stayed the same?
It stays the same with one exception. That's a very good question. The Codex Committee on Contaminants in Food, which was hosted by the Dutch government. It used to be known as the Codex Committee on Contaminants and Food Additives. Contaminants in Food and Food Additives. But then China came along and they wanted their own committee, so they broke apart that committee and gave China the Codex Committee on Food Additives, and they gave China the Codex Committee on Pesticide Residues, which used to be hosted by other countries. One was the Dutch, I forget who hosted Pesticide Residues. And so with that exception, yeah, they stayed the same, but China had enough clout that it could, demand and actually get two committees. And so, yeah, they stayed the same. The Hungarian government hosts the Codex Committee on, it's called CCMAS, M-A-S. CCMAS, it's Methods of Analysis, and I forget what the S stands for. But anyway, I've never gone to one of those committee meetings, but I've gone to the Canadian hosted Codex Committee on Food Labeling. We attended it quite extensively when we were trying to get GMO foods labeled, and we almost succeeded.
What country heads the food labeling?
Canada.
Okay.
So I've been to meetings in Ottawa, Quebec City, Calgary, But mostly now they hold, to save money, they just hold them in Ottawa these days. But also now they're Zoom meetings, so it doesn't really matter. The Codex Committee on Fresh Fruits and Vegetables is hosted by Mexico, but that's never been a, you know, we don't have unlimited resources, so we have to pick and choose, and that's never been a high priority committee for NHF, so we haven't attended that. The one that is important is the, believe it or not, is the Codex Committee on Residues of Death, Drugs and Foods Committee, otherwise known as CCRVDREF, and that's hosted by the U.S. government. That's where they debate the standards on residues of death, drugs and foods, obviously from the title of the committee, but residues like zilpaterol and ractopamine. And we've been, NHF was the most responsible delegation for stopping the zilpaterol standard at the last meeting, and also the meeting in Chicago. They were, Merck was, who makes the drug, it's given to these animals, were furious at us, at NHF, at me in particular, and really did a sniping campaign against me and NHF at the committee level. So the way it works with Codex is a country proposes, there are other committees I could tell you about, the Codex Committee on General Principles, that's hosted by France, and that is, there's something like 25 committees now, and that is held, usually was held in Paris, and I was living in Paris, so it was very easy for me, cheap for me to go attend those meetings, and they're the ones that establish the Codex Procedural Manual, which they follow. Maybe I should give you the overview of the structure. So, kind of the parent, and you'll understand why I said kind of, is the Codex Alimentarius Commission, meets once a year, and it considers the work of the underlying committees. Mm-hmm. But the underlying committees really usually can't do all the work themselves. So they themselves delegate portions of their work to either PWGs or EWGs. EWGs are electronic working groups. PWGs are physical working groups. And these days, again, in the COVID and post-COVID environment, they're usually EWGs. And they do a lot of the number crunching, and they rely in turn, you can imagine, draw a line out to the right or something, the scientific bodies of Codex, like JECFA and JUMPER and these other groups that review the science and then make their recommendations at the committee meetings, many times at the EWG level or PWG level, but definitely at the committee level. And then again at the commission level when the work of the committee is considered for adoption. But then I said kind of the parent body is Codex, but Codex itself was created in kind of 1961 to 63, finalized in 63 by the World Health Organization and the FAO. Mm-hmm. And so they are technically the parent bodies, but if you're just considering Codex within itself, there's the Codex Alimentarius Commission.
Right.
But it's run by the Codex Secretariat based in Rome. Hmm. Because the FAO, I mean, individual countries like the U.S. help and the EU help contribute money to the operating expenses of Codex.
Right.
But if you take the basic kind of general revenue that they can count on, the FAO pays 85%, and the cheapskate WHO pays 15%. And as you probably know, but WHO considers itself the equal of FAO, despite that, as far as Codex is concerned. And they have their representatives there sitting at the head table, and along with the FAO. But we at NHF, of the two, I mean, it's sort of like a choice between Hitler and Mussolini.
Right.
But FAO is kind of the Mussolini, and WHO is the Hitler. And WHO is considered to be very drug-oriented, and FAO is much more food-oriented. So you can imagine which is the better of the two organizations.
Right.
The FAO has a more kind of nutritional orientation, whereas WHO has a hit him over the hammer with the head with a hammer drug approach.
Right.
And so we're more at odds with WHO than we are with FAO. And by the way, the Codex Secretariat for years, maybe not so much anymore, but for years, used to love us. The Codex, they never take a vote at the committee level.
Mm-hmm.
They rarely take a vote at the commission level. They prefer, and it's written into the Codex Procedural Manual, chairman, chairwomen should try to arrive at a consensus before moving up the 8-step ladder of adoption. You know, what I was starting to tell you before, and then I diverted myself, is every standard guideline or code of practice that's proposed by a committee, when it's being considered, it has to pass up an 8-step process, which they've kind of shortened to a 5-step process by combining certain steps. So usually what happens is it'll be considered, the broad wording, every word is on the table. And then as they approve certain sections, they move it up by consensus agreement at the committee level to step 3/5. It used to be, when I first started going, it was 3, 4, and then 5. Now they just do 3/5. And then at the 3/5 stage, it goes to the very next meeting after the committee meeting, it goes to the commission to be reviewed, the standard does, or the guideline. A guideline is defined as general principles that you apply for arriving at a particular number, like what should be the maximum residue level for zilpaterol in animal tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the guideline will tell you, how do we arrive at that, you know?
Right.
And the standard will have the actual hard numbers.
Okay, and so these working groups, though, are these, what I'm trying to get at is, with most agendas, our government likes to give grants out to the NGOs, which are essentially the billionaire globalists that are already running everything. So I'm trying to understand who these working groups are.
Yeah. Okay, let me finish with that explanation.
Okay.
So the chairperson will, which I hate, I always call him chairwoman or chairman, and will ask a country to chair or co-chair a working group and arrive at some hard numbers or some general principles, if it's especially contentious.
Okay.
And so then anyone who's a Codex member state or anyone who's accredited by Codex as an INGO can say, I want to be on that EWG or the PWG. Sometimes NHF says that, and other times we don't. Depends on what our resources are and our interests are.
Okay.
So if we as an INGO can do it, then that means Monsanto, with its INGO, can do it too. Or Merck, with its INGO, can do it. You know, they all have these nice little names, like the aspartame industry has the calorie control councils, you know, and then Merck for its animal drugs has health for animals. That's the name of theirs. But we call them drugs for animals because that's all they're recommending is not nutrition. They're recommending drugs.
Right.
So, and then Monsanto has this fabulous name called Crop Life. And that's their INGO at Codex. So often NHF is the only one battling hard against Crop Life, Calorie Control Council, and Health for Animals, and they hate our guts, and we don't particularly like them either. But anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying anyone can be on the EWG. Most of the accredited INGOs at Codex are just trade industry groups, like the World Sugar Research Organization,
okay,
or the International Grocers Manufacturers Association. There are really only a handful of consumer organizations there. NHF is the main one. We go to the most meetings of any of the consumer organizations, by far, and we're the most vocal, except on the infant formula question, we're the most vocal on every other issue before Codex, like Zilpaterol, glyphosate. We're the only voice against glyphosate, that sort of thing. But Consumers International, except on the vitamin question, they're pretty good. The Helen Keller Institute is good on the infant formula. ILCA, International Lactation Consultants Association, they're good on the infant formula issue. International Baby, is it, I forget, Baby Formula Action, I forget that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are all very good organizations on those issues, but they all spring from left-wing origins, so they have no real interest in, like, health freedom.
Right.
So when it comes to an issue like having, you know, therapeutic doses of vitamins and minerals and nutrients, they're just as bad as Australia. You know, they think vitamins and minerals are dangerous and they need to be tightly regulated by countries. They see them as a plot by the industry to mislead the consumers and all of that. So they're absolute morons when it comes to that. They're out to sea without an oar. But on some basic contaminants issues, they're pretty good. And it's the same way with the European Union. You know, our biggest allies, NHF's biggest allies at the meetings are really the EU on anything having to do with contaminants in foods. Even the glyphosate issue, they're kind of good on, but they just don't take a strong stand on it.
Huh.
You know, they're like the 99-pound weakling on the beach who lets the U.S. and Canada and Australia kick sand in their faces.
Right.
They just went out. And it was the same thing on Zilpaterol. You know, at the Chicago meeting where we stopped it, NHF really stopped it. But you need a country to support you because an INGO alone can't stop something. Not if it's the only voice against it.
Right. Well, right. And so my number one question that I know is going to be everyone's number one question is, how is it that they allowed you, I know you had to like apply for this to be accredited and whatnot, but how is it that they allowed you to attend and speak, and year after year they continue to without booting you out?
That is a good question. Well, the third year, it was really thanks to the FDA because I was on the U.S. delegation for 2 years. And then I became known as such a troublemaker on the delegation that Elizabeth Wheatley, the third year, refused to let me on the delegation.
Hmm.
And that forced me to then figure out a way to get NHF accredited. And I applied 3 times. I applied for NHF to become an accredited delegation. The first 2 times they turned us down, partly, you know, because of our name. It sounds like we're just a national organization. You have to be international to be in Codex.
Right.
And I pointed out, despite our name, we are actually international. Because if you look at all the other INGOs, they're like international this, international that,
right,
blah, blah, blah. You know, there's nothing that's national. But I didn't want to change our name, so I just explained it. We have groups in Sweden, we have groups in Ireland, we have groups in Italy. and so on. So that convinced them, and they let me on 2 weeks ahead of the 2002 meeting, let NHF on as accredited. And it's the best thing that ever happened, because now instead of being muzzled, we had a microphone just the same as the U.S. did.
Nice.
We could submit written documents just the same as they could. We could go and talk to other delegations and lobby them for positions against the U.S. position or anyone's position. And so it was great. But it wasn't all, you know, a bed of roses. 5 years later, they tried to kick us out. It's like, I think someone was asleep at the wheel in 2002. They didn't really know what we were about, you know, and they thought we were just like a debate club or something. Who knows?
Right.
But anyway, they let us in, and then once they let us in, it was kind of too late, and then they tried to get rid of us in 2007. But by then, I had cultivated a lot of good contacts in the Codex Secretariat's office, and actually, they had been listening to us for 5 years, and privately, they agreed with our positions.
Yeah.
You know, I even had the legal counsel for the FAO come up to me at one point. I can't remember which meeting, maybe the Codex Committee on Food Labeling, after I'd spoken out on something and said, you know, we agree with you, but, you know, I can't, if you say I agree with you, I'll deny that I said that. But so I think they kind of, you know, agitated behind the scenes to keep us. And in fact, I was able, through argument, to convince them. And I also kind of threatened them. I said, you know, it's better to have us inside the tent than outside causing trouble for you. And you look better because it looks like you're all-inclusive umbrella.
Right.
You know, what? And so I think a combination of things led to us being in. And they haven't tried to kick us out since, because they know we're international, number one. Number two, we participate actively in the meetings. We're one of the most participatory INGOs there. And so the only other grounds would be, if you're not national, is that you are, you know, not active in the meetings anymore. And they've kicked out a couple of, they kicked out the 49th Parallel Consortium because they, with being active, they were very anti-GMO group of Canadians.
I was just going to ask, are there other organizations who have tried to get accredited and be a part of this?
Yeah, like the Rima LeBeau organization, Natural Solutions Foundation, actually tried to blackmail us to extort it from us, not in a criminal way, but in a civil extortion way. They tried to get us removed from Codex because we wouldn't let them on our delegation because we knew they weren't the type of people we agreed with. So they didn't get on. And there might have been some others. It actually is difficult right now. If we were applying now, I doubt we'd get on. I doubt we'd get accredited. It's like after they realized the mistake, they pulled up the ladder, and
right.
Space.
And are you the only one who attends, or are there other people from your group that attend these meetings?
It's mainly me, but there are other people on behalf of NHF. Catherine with a K, Catherine Carroll, like Lewis G. Carroll. Catherine Carroll's attended. She's probably attended the most meetings of any woman, female health freedom activist. And
is that Carroll or?
No, that's it. Two R's, two L's.
Okay.
And she's our NHF operations director and articles editor for the magazine. And she's attended a lot of meetings. From Hong Kong to Berlin? Well, Hamburg, I think they had one in Hamburg. And so, and then Brigida Lauren, an LA NHF member and activist, she attended the food hygiene meeting and actually did a lot of good at that meeting on our behalf. And Dave David Noakes, our chairman of the board, he's been to about three of the meetings. But I'm always the head of, except for that food hygiene meeting that was held in LA, and I wasn't going to be there. Dan Kinner went to a food hygiene meeting in San Diego. They were the heads of delegation then, but every meeting I've attended, I've been the, have been the ones that Kat Carroll's gone to and David Noakes has gone to. I've been the head of delegation speaking out. Okay. So yeah, it's mainly me.
Okay, so now you had said that the Fresh Fruits and Vegetables Committee out of Mexico is not one that's one of your top priorities, but in what I'm working on right now, it's a huge priority because of them trying to remove traditional farming and take all of this to indoor growing facilities, and they're doing this in multiple countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, priorities change. And now that certain issues like the Nutrition Committee meeting and the Contaminants in Food Committee used to be real high priority committees for us.
Right.
Because what they were covering, and now they aren't really, especially the CCCF meetings, they aren't covering really high priority stuff for us. So we have the ability to shift the things that are higher priority. And that could include, in fact, I was just talking with one of our board members about starting to attend the Fresh Fruits and Vegetables Committee meetings there. But, you know, one of the ways they, as you know, that they're making things difficult, especially for the small and medium-sized producers, is if they increase the regulatory burden on them.
Oh, yeah.
They'll drive them out of business, and
yep.
They love doing that.
Yep.
The big corps that can afford the attorneys and the accountants and all of that, but not the little guys and gals. And so they do that. And so at a lot of these Codex meetings, we try to oppose anything that might lead to, realize, of course, Codex is not creating regulations. They're creating standards and guidelines and codes of practice that member states will then use to create regulations.
Right.
Rules. So a lot of people get it wrong. They say Codex passed a law, or they say Codex passed a regulation. No, Codex doesn't do that. But, you know, most of these countries, especially the third world countries, are so, they don't have the infrastructure themselves to create their own regulations or standards or guidelines. They look to Codex, and they will often, the poorer country especially, will adopt the Codex standard as their own before Codex even adopts it.
Well, the USDA is 100% on board, because I was looking through their information on Codex, and they're talking their master plan, I think it was from like 2019 through 2023, was to make sure that they are completely in line with Codex standards and that they are going to take the lead on making sure other member states fall in line too.
Yep, that's right. Every country member head of delegation, member state head of delegation is a bureaucrat. They're an FDA equivalent or a USDA equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they often wouldn't know good nutrition if it hit them over the head with a bulldozer or something.
Right.
So they're, and I would say, you know, a lot of them have very strong agendas to control the food supply.
Yep.
Then there are the innocent fellow travelers who think they mean well and they buy into their arguments. And then there are the ones who are kind of the rebels, and those are few and far between, and often are politically unpopular elsewhere. You know, the rebels are, believe it or not, like Russia, Iran, and smattering of African countries. And so often NHF will find itself arguing on the same side as Russia or Iran or, you know, some obscure African country.
Right, right. Well, it would be great to have a fly on the wall for me at the Fresh Fruits and Vegetables, because I'd love to know what they're talking about with these, with the gene editing, because where it's all going in these vertical growing facilities is, you know, Bayer Monsanto is involved. They just built a facility or leased a facility out in California to start producing gene-edited seeds for these vertical indoor facilities. You got 100 labs in Silicon Valley working on this. And, of course, they're selling it, and the USDA is selling it like this, too, as the, you know, the imagine the walking into a grocery store and getting fresh food that was just harvested within 2 weeks just down the street that are all located in metropolitan cities where they want to cull the masses to the smart control grid. So they sell it as this, it's fresh and it's more nutrient, which is a crock, and it's, you know, more plump and more colorful. And look at how fast we can grow it and all the water we're going to save. And we don't have to worry, you know, climate change and sustainability and all this good stuff with a goal to replace traditional farming. So that means all of our produce and all the ingredients from the produce that goes into our food is now going to be controlled by these globalists who are all invested in this to... and have contracts with all these major grocery stores already. So, I mean, they won't even have to worry about regulations anymore. They're just going to take all the power away from them.
Yeah. So you see the threat with vertical farming as being more a control issue and a depleted nutrient issue?
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of times we lob hand grenades into the meeting that way. Like, just these kind of loaded questions, but in a good way, not a nasty way.
Right.
And, just gets them to thinking, because a lot of times it's about planting a seed rather than, you know, at the last meeting on the CCCF meeting in May of this year, NHF was the only one to mention when they were trying to establish mercury levels in fish to say, look, you can't just look at the mercury levels in an absolute sense, you have to look at them in a relative sense to the selenium content in the fish. You can have really high levels of mercury, but if you have much higher levels of selenium, it's not going to be an issue for human consumption as opposed to, say, another fish species that has very low levels of selenium, but maybe has half the level of mercury as in that other fish that had the high selenium levels, because the reason that mercury is toxic in fish is because it binds with the selenium to keep it from operating in the brain. That's the reason it's toxic. If you have enough selenium to quench and bind with, they're like magnets, they attract each other, the selenium and mercury, and then they get bound and then get excreted out harmlessly from the system. But if you don't have enough selenium, then the mercury is very toxic for the brain, for elsewhere.
Interesting.
That's the real danger. And that's what no one at Codex knew that.
Wow.
And pointed it out. And we've done it for the last two or three committee meetings. And this time we actually submitted a written document on it. And so no one took it into account. But these things are like planting seeds, like we did with melamine at the CCCF meeting in 2009, are like what we did with the vitamin mineral levels in 2009 Dusseldorf.
But how can they not know this and try to set standards? Why would they not have scientists or nutritionists like having this data readily available?
Yeah, that's where they go to JECFA, the joint expert, the WHO FAO joint expert committee on food additives, JECFA, and abbreviated, and they rely on them on science. And a lot of these Codex member states are like religious cultists when it comes to this science religion.
Right.
And they They refuse to believe any science that's not been given to them by Jagtfo. So they are like, why do we have Jagtfo if we don't believe everything they say? And my retort to it at many a committee meeting has been, so you're proposing that we just replace ourselves, all these meetings, with a clerk with a rubber stamp that says approved and adopted, because when the Jagtfo science comes in, they just rubber stamp it, and without any discussion as to the science or as to the policy of applying the science. And so what are we doing here with these meetings? Let's just hire a clerk. Instead of having 300 participants, we can have one clerk who just, when the Jagtfo science comes in, they say approve and move it up the ladder, the 8-step ladder. I said, Codex, they're risk assessors, they're risk managers, and we're the risk manager. So the risk assessor is Jagtfo. So we don't automatically adopt whatever the risk assessor says. We're the risk manager. We have to take into account policy.
Right.
You know, I have to remind these people this, and they still don't believe me because, you know, I'm an INGO.
Right.
So, you know, they don't, you know, I'm not an important government bureaucrat.
Right. The WHO, in an attempt to put the WHO in charge here of everyone, they have a whole food policy in place, a worldwide food policy already set to go. It's 56 pages long. I haven't had time to finish reading it, but we're talking, they are hardcore pushing the gene edited, the nanotech, the AI, you know, tracking from seed to plate, all of this. And, and even get into the whole, you know, swaying people's opinions and behaviors in it. So we know that's where they're heading. So I got to believe that Codex is going to be somewhat in line with trying to, well, in fact, they even say that in this 56-page document that they're going to rely on Codex to assist in implementing this. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and Codex standards ever since the 1994 GATT round, and it became the WTO, Codex standards have been super important. Before that, they weren't that important. The meetings were sparsely attended.
Because
once there is an enforcement mechanism, it became very important, and you start seeing a lot of corporate interest piling in. And, oh, and, you know, the same way I was on the U.S. delegation, there were people like from Coca-Cola and other people who were on the U.S. delegation. So when I spoke out against glyphosate at the Hong Kong meeting in, 2015 or something? Anyway, there was a whole row, 44 individuals attending on behalf of the, like, Merck, Monsanto, INGOs, and they all snickered in laughter at my suggestion that glyphosate might be dangerous. And I mentioned those 44 people, but actually there are many more because they're sprinkled amongst the country delegates as well.
Right.
Like there might be a Coca-Cola salesman in Uganda who's on the Ugandan delegation. Mm. Or there might be a Monsanto minion, you know, in Germany, and he's on the German delegation.
Yeah. How many corporations, especially the nefarious ones, would you say that, because that was one of my questions, what role do the corporations play in these meetings? And, like, are we talking a lot of them? Do they get any say in this matter? I mean, obviously, if they're delegates,
yeah,
they get a say.
Yeah, they're like, well, you know, here's the thing. Technically, we're called observer delegations. And so a lot of people who, you know, some of the health freedom groups that aren't, which is all of the other health freedom groups that aren't accredited by codex, so they aren't able to attend like NHF does. But a few of them who were kind of, envious of our position, they tried to denigrate us by saying, oh, the Observer NHF, you know, kind of implying that all we can do is observe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. Even though we're called Observer delegations, we participate as actively as any member country. It's just they'll call on the member state or, you know, the country delegations first,
right,
if we're considering our opinion, but our opinions. But to answer your question, yeah, Monsanto, aspartame, the sugar industry, the Grocers Council, the International Food Institute, Institute for Food Technology, sorry, IFT, all of those are kind of pro-GMO, pro-high-tech food, control of the food processes and all of that. They're there. Interestingly enough, the only one with integrity that we've seen, well, there were two actually, but I never see the one anymore, is the International Dairy Federation. I mean, obviously they protect dairy interests as opposed to competitor, but they've been, their delegates, and they've even been on the same side, like on the saturated fat issue and stuff like that, at Codex meetings in the Nutrition Committee. But they have a lot of integrity. I've seen where they could have taken advantage of a situation if they had just said yes, like they had been misunderstood, and they said no, knowing the consequence. They actually said, no, we didn't say that. We actually only did this study. We didn't do, you know, the mini studies you think we did.
Right.
So I've really appreciated those people. But a lot of the others are just snakes in the grass.
So like IFT, are they considered a delegate where they can contribute and talk?
Yeah. Institute for Food Technology, I think is their name, or it might be International Food Technology, but I think it's Institute. They have so-called experts who are asked their opinion, or not actually asked, but offer their opinion at times.
Okay.
And but they're in league with Monsanto and the others. They're all cut from the same cloth. They just kind of cloak it over with the degrees that they have and all of that. But
so,
usually,
go ahead.
Usually they're just mainstream thinking. Don't think out of the box. Don't think about the consequences,
right,
of their actions, kind of people.
So how often would you say Monsanto Bayer gets involved in these?
They're involved in all the important committees to them, like the pesticide residue, the food additives committee hosted by China. Merck attends definitely the vet committee, you know, the residue of vet drugs and foods committee, the hosted by the U.S. government. They attend the commission level meetings, just as we do.
So going back to the animals, so you're saying all animal food is also, they set the standards and guidelines for?
Well, no, I wouldn't, well, it kind of is, but realize the committee's called the Residue of Vet Drugs and Foods Committee. So it's CCRVDF. And that's determined by what drugs get into animal tissue that are then consumed by humans. So it's a very specific committee.
Okay. But not, but we're not talking about actual pet food.
No, we are,
right,
not. We're talking about human food.
Got it.
Correct is only concerned with human food to the extent it's consumed by humans.
Okay. Let me scroll.
Either directly or indirectly.
Gotcha. So in addition to control, you know, well, guidelines and standards when it comes to various ingredients, What about as far as the growing process or manufacturing of it? I know we talked about the labeling a little bit, but what about the whole, like, you know, now, for example, moving into indoor growing facilities where they're using robots and certain sprays and solutions in the water, and they're not, no, you know, and LED lights instead of the sun, water and solution instead of soil, and gene edited. So that's a whole new process.
Yeah. I think it's an educated guess on my part because I haven't really followed that much. It's been very specific as to certain issues rather than sort of broad strokes.
Right.
Stuff.
But they're literally talking about how new technologies for food production must be fully assessed from a public health point of view before products are placed on the market. In this regard, the Codex Alimentarius will play a key role in addressing the emerging and critical issues related to the usage of new technologies in a timely manner. This is from the...
Yeah, what they're doing is... Sorry to interrupt you, but what they're doing is they're bringing up new... These are new issues, and they'll be considered by the committees. But, you know, for the last 22 years that I've been going, I haven't really seen them addressed yet by the committee, but I'm certain they have plans to address them.
Okay. All right. And have you heard them talking about, like, foodborne disease or antimicrobial?
Oh, no, absolutely. And they have booklets out on foodborne disease. They have for, you know, a decade or so.
Yeah, because they're using foodborne disease and antimicrobial resistance as their reason to push in this direction. And so
yeah.
I'm concerned,
well,
they're going to pull like a scare tactic on that.
Yeah, they will. Yeah, there is a task force on antimicrobial resistance, the TFAMR, that was in existence, hosted mainly by the Korean government. There's another government involved, but it was really the Korean government. And that met for a number of years. I think it's been dissolved as of last year. But I think we attended, NHF attended one of their meetings in Norway. They held a physical working group meeting. Well, actually, it was the task force. It wasn't a physical working group, but it was an in-person meeting. And we sent two of our NHF members from Scandinavia there, from Denmark and Sweden. Denmark and England, but she was part Norwegian. Anyway, they attended and argued on that. And at the Codex Committee at the commission meeting level last year, and then a previous meeting, NHF argued that glyphosate was a major contributor to antimicrobial resistance. And Monsanto really tried hard to get that comment stricken from the record because they really didn't like it. But we had the science behind us to point it out. And we had made the argument, and since the Codex Secretariat was on our side, they let the comment stand in the report.
Nice. What is it that individuals can do to fight against this or protect themselves?
But I would say, yeah, maybe you don't petition Codex itself, because that would be wasted, but you could petition your Codex office to take of the country you live in, to take a position. If enough people did it, maybe they would listen. Maybe not the big states like the U.S. or something. But,
right.
You know, they're so embedded. They're so corrupt.
I know.
Get them to do anything. So the other thing is to write your Congress critters and get them to lean on the Codex office. The other thing is, when Trump was elected in 2016, there was a small chance that I would be appointed head of the Codex office for the U.S.
Mm.
So Trump gets elected in 2024. By then, I might have enough clout to get appointed to head that office, and I could clean everything up in the U.S. Instead of being there talking on behalf of NHF, I'd be there talking on behalf of the U.S.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
So that's kind of the best thing we can do. The other thing is to have member states withdraw from Codex. You know, that's the other thing. But it's a tough situation because they've gone so far down the road.
Right.
And they've created such an infrastructure, and you have people believing in the infrastructure.
Oh, I know. I know. I did want to ask you a little bit more on the whole dietary supplements, because I know that's, I see that as becoming a big problem too, just especially after what they pulled the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. We fought that battle for 10 years, and we actually had a good number of victories on it, but anywhere we're near where we wanted to be. And I think there are a lot of conflicts of interest in the Czech panels where they're reviewing the science, and
all the science, is bought and paid for with Big Pharma too.
Exactly.
Yep. And the universities, let's get them to pump out the narrative for us and make it believable, so we can get the grants
and the journals who depend, you know, a lot of their income. You know, we think about conflicted authors whose studies are published there, but it's not just that. It's also the fact that the reprints of their articles and their issues are a substantial part of their revenue,
mm-hmm.
and only come when the corporations order them a favorable scientific studies, favorable to Monsanto or Merck, whoever. And so there's a big drive for the reprint business for these scientific journals to print pro-corporate, articles so
right.
they can get the reprint money off of it.
Yep.
Because you and I aren't the ones ordering reprints of something that shows that glyphosate is harmful in their scientific journal. But if it shows it's safe, boy, Monsanto's going to order tens of thousands of those.
Right. That's right.
I forget what the percentage was, but it was an astoundingly high percent of their income for the scientific journals.
Wow. Well, I appreciate this. And
my pleasure. Thanks, Corey.
Thanks so much, Scott.